California has more trees now than at any time since the late Pleistocene. And it comes as no surprise to residents of the San Joaquin Valley that our cultivation of trees has played a defining role in shaping the California we know today. In his new book, Trees in Paradise, author Jared Farmer looks at the history of California as told through its trees, and specifically four types of trees: redwoods, citrus, eucalyptus, and palms. In it, he draws some fascinating connections between our trees and our culture, from our attitudes towards immigrants to the birth of California's environmental movement and the very picture of the California dream itself. Jared Farmer joins us now from NPR member station KUER in Utah. Jared, welcome.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
First of all, you look at those four trees I talked about earlier. Why those four groups of trees? There's so many that one could look at in California.
Yeah, it was hard choosing them. I mean, I could have done 5, 10, 100. Four seemed like a good number. It's somewhat arbitrary, but a lot of books have four case studies, and I was drawn to four. I had to do redwoods and sequoias. I grouped them together at the first part of the book because they are, justifiably so, the most famous trees in the world. They are the ultimate tree. When people think about California, they think first of like the oldest, largest, tallest trees in the world. After that, it became more difficult. I decided ultimately to focus on non-native trees because I thought that was the really important story that hadn't been told as much, because I think that the horticultural transformation of California was just as important as the gold rush in the long run. And also, most Californians, of course, have relatively shallow roots. Many Californians don't even go back one or two generations. So this book is about non-native trees and also people who come from other places and people who plant trees to kind of create a new California and how Californians change the state as they moved in. So a lot of people are disappointed that I don't do oaks. That's the one that if I were doing a fifth, it would be oaks. But I decided that eucalyptus allowed me to kind of explore a similar issue with oaks, which are kind of the quintessential indigenous tree in terms of Native Americans. And when you think about rootedness and belongingness in California, I think you often think of a gnarled valley oak or blue oak or coast live oak. With eucalyptus, I sort of talk about the flip side of that, which is the most sort of iconic non-native tree, a tree from Australia that was brought in huge numbers, that has completely transformed the landscape of lowland California. And I really explored, what does it mean to be native through this non-native tree? So I sort of did oaks through eucalyptus. And then after that, I decided I had to do a commercial tree, of course, because tree crops are still an enormous part of the economy of California, especially Fresno and Tulare counties. And citrus seemed like the obvious choice. It's no longer the most important. Actually, almonds are the most important tree now in the valley, but citrus is still right up there. And for many, many decades was the number one crop in California. And then I end with palms. And I decided I wanted to focus kind of on the personal side of the California dream, this idea that you can give your life a makeover, talk about more about beauty and image and fashion. And I wanted to talk a little bit more about, you know, Hollywood and LA, and sidewalk palms end up being like a good way to do that, this whole kind of promotional aspect of the California dream. So the book tries to span north to south, coast to the Sierra. It does take the Great Central Valley seriously, I think, unlike a lot of California history books. And, you know, Fresno County is definitely a big part of the book.
And of course, just this past weekend, the residents of Sanger made their annual trek up Highway 182, the General Grant, the nation's Christmas tree. And that's been such a big part of the identity of that community and of this part of the state. Let's start.
It used to be a really big radio show. Like the president of the United States and the governor would kind of write messages for the radio show. It's a little smaller affair now.
Yeah.
But there was actually this long rivalry between Tulare County and Fresno over who had the oldest tree in the world. And so the state chamber of commerce got involved and they had this kind of mock board of disinterested engineers who determined that the General Sherman was the largest tree in the world, which actually it is, and the General Grant was beyond dispute the oldest tree in the world. That was the official pronouncement, which is absolutely not true, but that was the pronouncement back in the 20s.
It was the political solution to the problem. Let's start with talking about redwoods and sequoias. These trees, from the first Western observers who came upon them, marveled at their size, their beauty, and at the same time, at the turn of the century, so many were lost, but it also sparked the conservation movement that we have today. How did that arc change throughout California's history when we look at the stumps in Converse Basin in Sequoia National Park today? It's shocking to think that not that long ago, we were destroying these incredibly ancient, incredibly beautiful trees for lumber. But how did that attitude change over time?
Yeah, it's a great question. Basically, the long arc of the story is how sequoias, and also redwoods, but sequoias first, made this transition from being thought of primarily as an economic resource to primarily a aesthetic or even a spiritual resource. And sequoias made that transition far, far earlier than the redwoods. Redwoods didn't really complete that transition until a few years ago when the last of the big timber wars ended in Humboldt County. With sequoias, basically that transition was complete by the mid-20th century, in part because it just wasn't a very good lumber tree compared to redwood. It grew really, really large, of course, but it's a very brittle tree, and it's also quite remote, and it was just a huge kind of engineering challenge to move the trees down the mountain. As you may know, there was actually a flume that went from Converse Basin down to Sanger, which billed itself as the Flumopolis of the West for a while. So basically, you had a whole forest of redwood that was cut down to create this flume, kind of like a log ride in an amusement park, to like send down this redwood, most of which just ended up being, you know, grape stakes and shingles. It's kind of, shocking and heartbreaking today. But basically, you see in the Sierra Nevada this twin American impulse. On the one hand, like, you find the biggest trees in the world and you want to knock them down just for the hell of it. You want to dance on the stump. You want to like send bark to the Crystal Palace in London and make some money. That's a very American impulse, and there were plenty of Europeans who were shocked and horrified that Americans would do this. But there's this other American impulse that we can be proud of, which is, you know, Americans invented the national park idea, and the very first national park in the world was Yosemite, you know, deeded to California originally, but it was reserved for the American public when Abraham Lincoln signed that law 150 years ago in 1864. And the Mariposa Grove in Yosemite National Park was part of that original bill. So the big trees were at the heart of the American conservation movement. And if you look at the creation of the Sierra National Forest and later national parks in the Sierra Nevada, you can see that, you know, big trees were a part of this impulse to protect trees in a novel way. So basically, Americans invented new ways to destroy trees and to really humiliate trees and to put them on display and make a fast buck. But they also invented new ways to protect and preserve and to appreciate them. So that's the kind of yin and yang of, you know, the American experience when it comes to these big trees.
The other common thread that runs throughout all of these trees that you look at in your new book, Trees in Paradise, is the impact that they play on the idea of California, the California mythology that's out there. In the case of the sequoias and the redwoods, this larger-than-life thing, you look at postcards from the late 19th century and you'll see fantastically large produce and things. Well, here in California, we also had these giant trees. How did they also fit into the mythology of California as this new strange land far away from the rest of the U.S. on the coast where trees were thousands of years old and larger than anything anyone could imagine anywhere else?
Well, it sort of seemed to confirm a pre-existing mythology, because the idea of California as this kind of mythical place where things are bigger and better and, you know, gold hangs from trees actually predates the American period. It predates the Mexican period. It goes back to these kind of old legends from the Spanish period. If you look at old maps, you see California as a separate island in the Pacific, and there were these kind of romantic tales of, you know, basically like Amazonian women riding griffins in the sky over this, you know, land of milk and honey. So when Americans arrived in large numbers, I mean, they were there before the Gold Rush, but arrived in large numbers after 1848, when they found these big trees, in addition to gold, in addition to other marvelous things, it just sort of confirmed this idea that this place is going to be different. It's going to be different by nature. And it's sort of fed into this kind of promotional machine, which has been at the heart of California from the beginning. But it wasn't just talk, right? Because California does have the only Mediterranean climate on a large scale in North America. So there are all sorts of crops, especially tree crops like almonds, walnuts, you know, citrus, pomegranates, avocados, you name it, that can only be grown on a large scale in California. And people recognize that this would be a big moneymaker and a big engine of economic growth very early on in the 1850s, you had horticultural boosters in the East Coast sort of recognizing this, you know, once we have a railroad connecting east to west, California would become basically the Mediterranean of America. And that largely became true. There were lots of, you know, fits and starts and economic and ecological calamities before you could, you know, buy a sun-kissed orange in Manhattan on Christmas Day. But in the long run, it did happen. So in a sense, like these dreams like predate America, and a lot of it was just hot air. But there was a kind of ecological reality having to do with the climate. But it required an enormous transformation. If you think about the Central Valley, it used to be largely a wetland, a seasonal wetland, marshland. You know, Tulare Lake was often larger than Lake Tahoe in surface area. So when you fly over or drive through the Central Valley today and you just see mile upon mile, millions of, you know, almond trees, walnut trees, citrus trees, you have to remember that this was once a very, very different landscape, also biologically rich, but more about, you know, fish and amphibians and birds and grizzly and elk, not so much about trees. The trees are a huge importation, a huge change, really a sort of a landscape regime change for the Central Valley.
We're talking with author Jared Farmer. His new book is called Trees in Paradise, A California History. You spend a lot of time in the book talking about immigration and as it relates to trees, immigration and naturalization. And I want to turn now to the eucalyptus, which is the first non-native tree that you look at in this book. And you talk about how attitudes to this foreign immigrant to California changed so dramatically over the years in the state. How was the eucalyptus first received in the state, and then how did that change?
It's been an enormous change. I mean, the long arc would be from great hopes to disenchantment to love to hatred for a lot of people, or mixed feelings at the least. So in the 1850s, Californians needed trees, period. Basically, you had this huge influx, hundreds of thousands of people, to a lowland environment that didn't have a lot of trees. And, you know, San Franciscans needed firewood, they needed building material, they proceeded to cut down all the oaks, they cut down all the redwoods nearby, and people realized we needed new trees, we needed replacements, and we just needed more. And eucalyptus trees were the most attractive tree for afforestation, for adding, because they were the fastest growing hardwoods in the whole world, and that's why they were popular not just in California, but in the British Empire, the French Empire, all over the colonial world. But people had sort of outsized hopes for these trees, that they would cure malaria, that they would change the climate of California, make it even better, that it would end timber famine in the United States. There were all these kind of like really, really high expectations. And the tree always disappointed, except for firewood, which it ended up being very useful because California lacked good coal before you had oil in the early 20th century. It was an essential firewood. But basically, you had these kind of waves of hope and disenchantment, that culminated in the early 20th century, 1909 to 1913, when there was a huge speculative bubble in eucalyptus, a kind of the California version of tulipomania, if you think of like Dutch history, where you had all sorts of suckers, you know, people in Chicago and New York betting their retirement on a little piece of eucalyptus property in California, and then people planting trees and flipping the land. That boom collapsed in 1913. And people haven't really planted eucalyptus on a large scale since then, but we're left over with these trees from the pioneer era, these legacy trees, which grew into some of the largest hardwoods in the world. And Californians eventually grew to love them as these kind of landmarks, as these icons of home, and I think they sort of related to them on a personal level, because if you weren't from California, if you came from someplace else, there was something kind of comforting about seeing a non-native tree that had grown so big, so rooted, that was such an important landscape feature. And they grew so big because basically there were no diseases or insects or pests from Australia in California at that time, so they were actually growing unnaturally large. So that was the moment of love, like in the early to mid 20th century, when you had California painters and poets, like Robinson Jeffers wrote a sonnet about eucalyptus, Ansel Adams made beautiful portraits of eucalyptus trees, etc. But then you get to the 1980s onward, and there's been an entirely flipped reaction among many Californians, and now they're often seen as ugly, messy, dangerous, hazardous, fire-prone, no good trees. But that's kind of like the big arc of the story.
We're talking with author Jared Farmer today about his new book, Trees in Paradise, and I want to turn now to citrus. You call it the industry of growth in the chapter that you introduce on those trees. And California really is, I guess you could say, the ultimate boom state, from the gold rush to the movie industry to high technology and the aerospace industry. But citrus fits right into that, and the growth of Southern California. Talk about how that fits into the California narrative that you present in your book.
Well, orange trees, probably more than any other fruit tree, are kind of mythical. I mean, it goes back to Greek mythology with a golden apple. It was the one fruit most associated with royalty and kind of luxury in sort of medieval, early modern Europe. And so this notion that in California you could grow oranges was an enormous draw for people. And lots of people tried citriculture even before the American period, but there were problems with shipping the fruit before the railroads, even after the railroads, before refrigerated cars. It was very, very hard to get the oranges to market. And also it was hard to find an orange that tasted good, you know, many days later, and also a fruit that was not too seedy. And there are all sorts of technical challenges also doing with water, because this is a subtropical tree. California is not a subtropical place, so you need to import water, find the right variety, have workers, shipping infrastructure. It's an enormous operation, and there were all sorts of failures before there were great successes, you know, decades of failures, including insect infestations. But finally, there was a fruit that was perfect for California. It was a varietal that first appeared in Brazil. It was a mutation. It was sent to Washington, D.C., later sent to California, ended up in Riverside. It was beautiful. It was seedless. It was sweet. And it grew really well in Southern California. And most importantly, it turned a beautiful orange color, because the primary value of the California orange is less the taste, even though the taste is very good. It's the color, because only when you have these like shifts in temperature between night and day and season do you get that coloration. Because in Brazil or Florida, the fruits will be green or mottled or actually kind of ugly, but it doesn't matter because you might just pulp it or turn it into orange juice, not sell it as a table orange. So California, it's mostly about the aesthetics. And so this one tree became the money tree, and every single navel orange is now growing in the Central Valley that used to grow in the Inland Empire and beyond came from a single genotype. Basically, it's all been grafted generation after generation. They're all clones of this one tree, which has been kept alive through this quite extraordinary tree surgery over the decades in Riverside. You can still go visit it. It's largely forgotten. It's in a little traffic meridian next to a nail salon and a taqueria, but it's still there. And it used to be kind of a shrine to horticulturalism. And if you sort of think about it, that one tree produced as much wealth as any gold mine, if you think about it on a genetic level. So that's the California story in a nutshell. But it took, again, all these technical challenges before Southern California figured it out. And then within a few decades after figuring it out, basically they all moved to the Central Valley because they could make more money selling their land as real estate to suburban developers. So it's really kind of an incredible story of failure, success, but then transplantation and moving the whole operation to the east side of the Central Valley.
And that's also something that you talk about in your book, the development of Southern California, the removal of all those trees. Of course, Orange County gets its name from that fruit, but it's rare to find.
There's not a single commercial orange grove in Orange County. The only orange grove in L.A. County is at the Huntington Botanical Garden. And appropriately, it's next to the mausoleum, and those trees are old and they're sick, and they're probably not going to survive citrus greening. And I don't think they will replace them. So really, it's all in the Central Valley now.
As we close, you close your book with a look at the ultimate California image tree, I guess you could say. When people think of Southern California, think of Hollywood, the palm tree is almost inevitably part of that picture in the mind. How did this tree come to so define the state and in its, I guess you could say, compared to the others, relative uselessness? Is that the right term? Would you agree with that? And how does it come to define the state?
It is useless, but it's not useless. I guess its use is its sign value or promotional or semiotic value. What they mean is what they do. You're right. There's not fruit. There's not shade when it comes to these really tall sidewalk palms you see in Los Angeles. And there is a small but important date industry in the Imperial Valley, but you know, for the most part, all of the palm trees you see in California are economically non-productive, but they are critically important for tourism, for promotion, for the image of California. Think of all of the television and movies shot in LA in the mid-20th century when these palm trees were becoming these iconic features growing above the sidewalk, sort of like the vertical access that matched the horizontal axis of the freeway. I think these were the two kind of master signs of LA in the mid-20th century. But that was all actually pretty new. If you go back to, say, 1900, LA is not known for its palm trees. It's known for its eucalyptus trees, its acacia, but most of all, its pepper trees. All these postcards of pepper trees, which are pretty hard to find now. Sacramento was way ahead of LA in terms of creating a palm landscape. So was Santa Barbara and San Diego. So really, this is a story of LA in the 20s and 30s when it put in its modern highway system, deciding to line them with palm trees systematically. And then those palm trees happened to grow up and grow really tall during the era when you had so many TV and movies shot in LA. So that's how it became cemented with the California, but especially LA image, so much so that I think now people in like Sacramento and the Bay Area have somewhat conflicted feelings about palm trees because they have these associations with Los Angeles.
Our guest today has been Jared Farmer. He is the author of the new book, Trees in Paradise, A California History. You can find it in better bookstores and online. Jared, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.